All right, folks, buckle up because we're about to dive into some constitutional law.
Oh, yeah. Those words don't always get everyone's pulse racing.
I know, right? But trust me on this one, this case is anything but dry.
Yeah.
We're talking Abington v. Shemp, that 1963 Supreme Court showdown about school prayer.
Oh, this is a big one.
Huge. I mean, it's something
Man.
so many of us probably experienced, back in the day.
Yeah.
And it really gets into these big kind of fundamental questions about, like, where does religion belong in public life? What are the boundaries?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. This case is foundational. I mean, we had Engle v. Vital back in 62 that tackled teacher-led prayer.
Right.
But Shemp kind of takes it to a whole other level. We're talking Bible readings, student recitations, like all that stuff that was so common in public schools back then.
Yeah.
And it's really here that the court's like, okay, we got to figure this out. Like, what does endorsement really mean? What actually makes something a religious exercise when it's happening in a school? It gets really nuanced.
Yeah, totally. And just to set the stage here, we've actually got two separate cases that get bundled up together. So we've got one coming out of Pennsylvania featuring the Shemp family.
Okay.
They were Unitarians, interestingly enough. And
Interesting.
they were objecting to these mandatory Bible readings happening in their kids' school.
Right.
And then on top of that, we've got a case from Maryland, and this is where Madeline Murray comes in.
Yeah, very famous.
Famous atheist activist, and she's fighting a pretty similar policy in her state.
Talk about, clash of worldviews, right? And the interesting thing is both of these cases had already been ruled unconstitutional in the lower courts.
Oh, wow.
So that already kind of tells you something about where the legal winds were blowing, the times there were changing, right? But the question is WHY? Why were these practices suddenly being seen as a problem?
And it's not like we're just talking about like a quick little verse here or there. I mean, this Pennsylvania law, it was pretty intense. It was like 10 verses a day minimum, plus the Lord's Prayer
Every day. Wow.
every day.
Yeah.
There was an opt-out, like you could get your kid out of it, but you got to imagine the pressure on a kid.
Oh, absolutely. Especially, in those days, to be the one kid who's like, I'm not doing this. It's tough. And that's really what the Supreme Court latched onto, this whole idea of coercion. Even with the opt-out, they recognized how much social pressure there was, especially for kids. Like, you don't want to be the odd one out, especially when it comes to something as, potentially sensitive as faith. And in a public school setting, you're talking about a captive audience of young, impressionable minds. That's a tricky situation.
So it really boils down to, the courts wrestling with this question. Do these practices actually cross a line?
The big line.
Yeah, the big one. Do school-sponsored Bible readings and prayers? Is that basically the government establishing a religion? Because that's a big no-no, right? First Amendment.
First Amendment, right
Yeah.
there. And in an 8-1 decision, the court's answer was a resounding yes.
Wow. Yeah.
This was a landmark ruling. It basically said it's not just the federal government that has to stay neutral when it comes to religion, but states too.
Okay.
Because remember, that 14th Amendment applies those First Amendment protections to the states.
So, okay, we got the verdict, but what's the logic, the reasoning behind it? I mean, how do they get to that decision?
Well, Justice Clark, he wrote the majority opinion, and he laid out these two key tests. The first one is the secular purpose test. Basically, for a law to be constitutional, it's got to have a reason for existing that has nothing to do with religion.
Got it.
And then there's the primary effect test, meaning the main effect of the law can't be to help or hurt religion.
Okay, makes sense.
And here's the thing. The court applied these tests to those school practices, the Bible readings and all that, and they said they fail both tests.
Oh, wow.
States tried to argue, oh, no, it's about morality, or, oh, it's about appreciating literature.
Like classic literature.
But the court was like, nope, we see right through that. The purpose and the effect are clearly religious.
So, I mean, to play devil's advocate a little bit here,
Yeah.
those who were in favor of school prayer, they had some points, right?
Yeah.
Like they talked about the importance of, teaching kids good values. And, the Bible as a work of literature, like there is value in that. So how did the court address those arguments?
Head on. They basically said, look, you can't just slap a secular label on something that's fundamentally religious. And those opt-out provisions, even if they're there with good intentions, they don't magically make the pressure disappear for the kids who choose to opt out. The court was very clear, studying religion objectively, like in a history class, literature class, that's fine.
Sure.
But when you're actually practicing religion, that's where the problem is in a public school setting.
All right. So we've got 8 justices on board with this.
Yeah.
But I want to take a look at some of those other opinions, the concurring opinions.
Yeah.
Because Justice Brennan, he had a really fascinating perspective. Like, he was basically warning against getting stuck in the past.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Taking these interpretations of the Constitution from 1789 and being like, all right, let's just apply these exactly as they are to this very different America of the 1960s.
Yeah, good point.
He's like, things have changed.
His point is so relevant even today, right? What worked back in the time of the Founding Fathers, that might not necessarily fly in a much more diverse, you know, pluralistic society.
Right.
And Justice Douglas actually, he kind of echoed this concern, adding that even little things like a state giving money to a religious school or letting them use a public facility,
mm-hmm.
he's like, that stuff can tilt the balance away from true neutrality.
Interesting.
Like, it can seem small, but it matters.
Okay, so we can't leave out our lone dissenter, Justice Stewart.
Right.
He had a different take. He saw this whole thing as an issue of free exercise of religion.
Oh, okay.
His argument was, hey, if kids want to pray, let them pray. As long as they're not being forced, what's the problem?
I see.
You know?
Yeah. His dissent actually raises a really interesting question. He asked whether the court should have actually demanded proof of psychological harm to those kids who were opting out.
Yeah.
You know, like, should they have to show they were actually being harmed?
Right.
And this gets to, like, how do you actually measure coercion?
So, yeah.
Especially in these situations that aren't so in your face, but can still have an impact.
Right.
It's a tricky question. Do you need hard evidence? Or is it enough to show that there's a potential for pressure?
Yeah.
It's not a simple answer.
So, I mean, the impact of Shemp, it didn't stop there, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely not. This thing, it's like a ripple effect.
Yeah, it's huge.
Along with Engel, those two cases, they essentially shut down those old school formal ways of doing school-sponsored prayer.
Right, right.
But, you know, the debate didn't exactly end there either, did it?
No, not at all. Yeah, it's like the court dropped this bomb with Shemp.
All right.
And everyone's kind of scrambling, trying to figure out, okay, what are the new rules of the game?
Totally. You've got teachers, principals, parents, everybody in education kind of left in this legal limbo.
Yeah.
Like, Shemp creates this vacuum, and all these later cases are kind of trying to fill it in, figure out the boundaries.
And one of those big cases, that was Levy Wiseman, 1992. This one was all about prayer at graduation ceremonies.
Well, yeah, that was a big one, too.
And again, you know, the court is divided, but they end up striking down this practice of having clergy-led prayers at public school graduation.
Right. And the reasoning there, it's very much in line with Shemp, right? The setting, the importance of graduation, the fact that you've got school officials involved, it all kind of creates that atmosphere of coercion, that pressure to conform.
Yeah, it's like you're sending this message. If you're not participating in this, you're somehow not part of the group.
Yeah, exactly. You're the outsider, the odd one out.
All right, so let's fast forward a few decades. 2022, we get Kennedy v. Bremerton. This one's about a high school football coach who's praying on the field after games.
Oh, yeah. This one got a lot of attention.
Huge.
Yeah.
And he's saying, hey, this is my personal expression of faith. I'm not forcing anyone to join me. But the school district is worried. They're like, this looks like we're endorsing religion, especially coming from a coach, someone with authority.
Right, because it's not just some random guy on the sidelines. He's the coach.
Exactly. So what happens?
Well, this is where things get really interesting. The court, by this point, has shifted, become more conservative.
Okay.
They actually side with the coach.
Wow.
They say his prayers are protected as private speech under the First Amendment. And they say there's not enough evidence to show that he was really coercing players into joining him.
So a pretty big shift there in how the court's thinking about these issues. Does this mean, like, we're just going back to school-sponsored prayer being the norm? Is Shemp basically irrelevant now?
That's the question, right? But I don't think we can say that Shemp is totally irrelevant. It's still precedent. It hasn't been overturned. You know, lawyers are still citing it in their arguments.
Right.
But yeah, it definitely seems like our understanding of that coercion factor, it's evolving. It's becoming more narrow, perhaps.
Which kind of brings us back to some of those real world situations we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
What about those moments of silence that some schools have? Are those okay? Are they like a sneaky way to bring prayer back into schools? or are they truly neutral?
That's the million-dollar question, right? And honestly, it comes down to intent and effect. That's what Shemp teaches us. If the purpose of those moments of silence is truly for personal reflection, whatever that means for each individual student, and if they're done in a way that doesn't make kids feel pressured to, you know, pray or do anything religious,
right, yeah,
then maybe they're okay. But you got to look at the details, you know? How are they implemented? What's the context?
The context matters a lot.
It's everything.
All right, what about student-led prayer groups? Is that a different story?
On the surface, yeah, they seem a little less tricky, right? Because they're initiated by the students, not the school itself. But Shemp's influence is still there.
Okay.
You know, the court has made it clear that schools can't create an environment where students feel pressured to join these groups.
Even indirectly.
Right. So, like, for example, if the prayer group gets to meet during lunch break, but other clubs have to meet before or after school, that could be seen as, like, giving preferential treatment to the religious group.
Right.
And maybe even subtly pressuring kids to join.
Okay, so it's all about being fair, making sure everyone's on a level playing field.
Exactly. Religious groups, non-religious groups, everybody's got equal access, equal opportunity.
All right, let's tackle the big one. Teaching creationism. Can schools teach that alongside evolution and say, hey, these are both legitimate scientific theories?
Oh boy, that one always gets people fired up.
It's a hot topic.
Yeah. And, you know, again, you got to go back to that two-prong test from Shemp, right? Secular purpose, primary effect.
Right.
Does teaching creationism really have a secular purpose? Is it primarily about advancing scientific understanding? Most courts have said no.
Okay.
They see it as trying to sneak religious teachings into science class.
Right. So it's not just about the label, it's about the substance.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court has actually weighed in on this too. In Edwards v. Aguiar, they ruled that teaching creationism alongside evolution violates the Establishment Clause.
Okay. So it's not just a lower court thing. The highest court in the land has said this is not okay.
Yep. They saw it as trying to push a specific religious viewpoint under the guise of science.
So, you know, even though some people might want to go back to a time when school prayer was common.
Yeah, like those good old days, some might say.
The law, as it stands now, shaped by Shemp and all these cases that came after it, it paints a different picture. It's all about balancing religious freedom with keeping that separation between church and state.
Yeah, it's like walking a tightrope. You got to find that balance, that sweet spot.
And it's a balance that we're still figuring out.
Always a work in progress.
Always. So, for our listeners out there, like the everyday folks trying to make sense of all this.
Yeah, it can be confusing for sure.
Let's say I'm a parent. My kid goes to public school. Mm. What are my rights? Like realistically, what can I expect when it comes to religion in the classroom?
That's the big question, isn't it? And the tough answer is there's no easy one size fits all answer.
Okay.
But even though it's been, you know, over half a century since Abington v. Shemp,
yeah,
it still offers us some valuable guidance.
So it's not just some dusty old case that doesn't matter anymore.
Not at all. Think of Shemp as a compass. It points us in the right direction, even if the terrain's a bit different now than it was back then.
I like that analogy.
At its core, it's all about this principle of religious neutrality in public schools.
Meaning no school-sponsored prayers, no Bible readings. But what about those gray areas we were talking
about? Yeah, the tricky stuff.
Like, can my kid pray silently during class? Can they wear a religious head covering or a cross necklace?
Yeah, those are the questions that really get people going.
Yeah.
And they don't always have easy answers. Generally speaking, students do have the right to pray silently, you know, as long as it's not disruptive.
Okay.
And they usually have the right to wear religious clothing and symbols, you know, within reason.
So there are limits.
Yeah, schools can have restrictions, dress codes, for example, but those restrictions have to be applied fairly.
Right.
They can't single out religious expression. They can't be discriminatory.
So it really does seem like it depends on the specifics, the circumstances.
Yeah, it's very context dependent.
So what happens if a parent feels like their child's rights are being violated?
Like they feel like the school's gone too far.
Yeah. Yeah, like they're being treated fairly. What can they do?
Well, the first step is usually, you know, try to talk to the school, see if you can work things out.
Okay.
Good communication can go a long way.
Yeah.
You know, respectful dialogue. Try to understand where the other side's coming from.
Right.
Often you can resolve things that way.
But if that doesn't work?
If it's more serious, if you can't come to an agreement, there are legal options.
Okay.
Parents can file complaints, you know, with the school district, the state board of education, and in some cases, they might even take legal action.
Wow. Okay.
And there are organizations out there that, you know, often get involved in these cases.
Like who?
Like the ACLU, for example, or the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. They advocate for, you know, students' rights.
So it's not always a clear-cut path.
It can be complicated.
It sounds like navigating religion in public schools, it takes like real careful thought, open communication, and really a commitment to both sides of the coin, religious freedom, but also that separation of church and state.
Absolutely. You've got to find that balance.
And Abington v. Shemp, even with all the debate it sparked, it kind of reminds us that the Constitution isn't this like static thing.
Yeah, it's not just words on a page.
Right.
It's a framework, a living, breathing framework that asks us to grapple with its principles, you know, to interpret them in light of how society's changing, how our understanding of individual rights is evolving.
It's like the court in 63, they gave us this puzzle.
A very complex puzzle.
And it's up to each generation to figure out how to put those pieces together in a way that makes sense for their time.
That's the beauty of a living constitution.
Right.
Right. It's a testament to those core principles that the founders laid out. They're flexible, they're adaptable, they can guide us through all sorts of challenges, you know, as society changes.
Well, that about wraps up our deep dive into Abington v. Shemp. I think it's safe to say this is a case that will continue to generate debate and legal challenges for years to come.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it really highlights those fundamental questions about religion, education, individual rights.
Yeah.
And those conversations, they're never truly over.
Right.
They're always evolving. And it's up to all of us, you know, as citizens to participate in those conversations, you know, thoughtfully, respectfully.
So to our listeners, we leave you with this. Shemp might have settled the issue of mandatory school prayer
back in the day,
but it opened up this whole new set of questions about how we handle religious expression in a society that's incredibly diverse, that values pluralism. So keep those questions in mind, stay curious, and as always, thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.
It's been a pleasure, and to everyone listening, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.